Well, Lord, let me bring hope and courage where there is despair. I'm Robert, an alcoholic addict. My sobriety date is July 6, 2005. I'm going to be 3 years next month, a month and a half or so. And I'm very grateful to be here tonight. Somehow I ended up at the doorstep a half an hour before the meeting, and I never come to this meeting on Sunday night, so I guess I'm supposed to be here, you know. I smiled when I was asked because I knew I knew beforehand. I was sitting back there going, well, I guess the way it's supposed to be, right? But I began using alcohol as a teenager, and for fun, like a lot of people, you know. In my family, we didn't have any real alcoholics. My father drank very, very moderately and on occasion, you know, Christmas, New Year's, family gatherings. My mother never touched alcohol at all. And my exposure to alcohol as a young person was mainly family gatherings where I would see people having a few beers and a glass of this or a glass of that and laughing and having fun and then the occasional family arguments and things. But I sort of developed the attitude towards alcohol that alcohol was the equivalent to fun, you know, fun and pleasure and a good time, you know. So by the time I hit 15, and my father is French-Canadian, my mother is English, so my friends were both mixed French-Canadian and English, and my buddies and I, you know, we started like around 15, 16, we'd swipe a beer here and there from the family, you know, from our parents and get together, and by the time we're 17 and we all had part-time jobs and working, we're buying a bottle of beer or a case of beer and a bottle of vodka or something. But so right away from the beginning, it was a party. You know, it was a way to have fun. But you know, the 60s in Montreal were quite a time, eh? Like by 65, I was down in old Montreal. I had a regular table there, 66, 67, year of Expo. Excuse me, I had a regular, my regular spots, you know, where I used to go, and I was down there 6-7 nights a week. And something I noticed today, like something that was, that I came to realize coming to these rooms was that I never actually drank to be sociable in any way, because I would go into Café Plexi, below the Iroquois Hotel there, sit down and drink four pitchers of beer, and I go in with a bottle of cognac or a bottle of vodka inside my jacket. So my intent was very clearly to get as stoned and as wasted as I could. You know, that was it, you know. And I wasn't alone, you know. There's always a lot of people there to keep you company, and, you know. You know, this progressive disease of mine did progress, much to my unawareness, because, you know, and most of the symptoms of my disease I was totally unaware of, like, you know, quitting jobs, losing girlfriends, losing friends, becoming isolated from my family, and, you know, the changes in attitude, values, and, you know, my appreciation of life gradually was modified, changed because of my use of alcohol and drugs, you know. Drugs came into the picture in the late 60s. But I can't say that I ever truly suffered. You know, the Lord was very merciful with me as He kept me apart from myself and my true feelings for a long time. He was actually quite gentle with me. So for a good 40 years, I got away with drinking and using drugs. I got away with it. I say I got away with it because there was never any actual traumatic experiences, you know. I was always moving one step ahead of the wave. You know, I was always getting up just in time before any of the bad stuff came down and moving along. And I managed to somehow travel pretty well around the world. got drunk in a lot of really interesting places. You know, I don't remember much of them, but I know I was there. But details and, you know, a lot of lost time, much lost time. When I went into rehab, finally, we had to write a 15-page resume of our lives, right? And it took me 6 months. And it was mostly blank. I lost years and years and years, you know, like gone, completely gone. And I'm just still, after 3 years of sobriety, I still haven't come back. Big empty spaces. Maybe it's a good thing, you know. But around 84, I guess, no, 83, around there, I started to have some serious symptoms, you know. And probably the worst experience I had in that time was realizing that I woke up one morning and I woke up. I sort of, it's not the right word, but I was so hungover, I was seeing triple, not double, but I looked into the kitchen and there was 12 empty bottles of wine on the floor. And I went, whoa, what happened there, you know? And I looked out my kitchen window and my boss's truck was gone. I was living in Vancouver. And I said, somebody stole the truck, you know? And my neighbor said, no, you went out last night. I said, I what? You know, he said, oh yeah, man. He said, we tried to stop you. He said, you went out. I said, no way. So finally, I found the truck on the other street, backed up with like the wheels on the sidewalk and more wine bottles. And I was drinking Chianti then, you know, like, but I realized that I had a major blackout, you know. I'd probably been having them for some time. I just never actually realized it. This was so evident that couldn't deny it, you know. So I decided I was going to slow down on my drinking and use more cocaine. That was one way, you know, like, because like a bit of coke and you don't feel the booze as much, and you can drink all night. And, you know. But that didn't work either, you know. That was pretty bad. And by 94, 95, I was a total disaster, you know. My addiction, my alcoholism was at a point where I could sit at, you know, I would empty a bottle of Glendening Scotch from midnight to 6 in the morning while other people were sleeping and go through $200-$300 a coke while other people were sleeping. You know, I'd be sitting there in the morning crying and thinking about these hardworking people who I just blew their week's salary while they were sleeping. And for some reason, I always had all the money I needed to do all of this. And like, money was coming to me, you know, out of the ceiling. And I realized at one point I really have to watch out what I asked for, because at one point I made a promise to God I wouldn't do any more cocaine. And I lasted 7 years. And when I finally got into a situation, I asked permission to do cocaine. I said, just a little bit, you know, I'll be really moderate, you know, like. And I ended up sitting with 11 pounds of cocaine, which was not moderate, you know, not at all. In the house, all over the place. Amazing. Police came to my house and they walked in the place and there was bags of coke all over the house. You know, they never found anything. They left me sitting there. They didn't see all the coke. I can't figure it out, you know. Like, I was looking for help, you know, like just, you know what I mean? Somebody do something for me, like, and, but it wasn't the right time. And, you know, I was the booze, I was just using to whack myself out. At that point, I mean, it's the only way I could get to sleep at night, was drink a bottle of wine and just pass out cold, plop, you know, like out. In 95, I started begging for mercy, because I knew that this didn't make sense anymore. I was, no matter what I was trying to do, no matter how I did it, life was miserable, totally, totally miserable. And no matter how good I was trying to be, you know, in my life. So I never actually thought I was doing anything wrong, because I was a very kind, good-hearted person, except that I was using drugs and I was using alcohol like a bottomless pit, you know, like, and I see now, because of that, no matter how much effort I was putting into being a good person, it was all being nullified by my abuses and my addictions, you know. But in 95, I started to pray, strangely enough. I lived in total defiance of God most of my life. But I was not in denial of God. I knew God was there. I could feel him through my bones. I could feel him in my life. There's no question about it. You know, I see people in these rooms who have a lot of difficulty to pray and to believe and to ask for help. I always believed very, very deeply. It was instinctive to me. I was raised, I felt the influence a lot of my grandmother, who was a real believer. And, you know, she really worked on me as a child. And like, she used to talk to me about God like he was coming for supper, you know. He's there, you know. And that's the way I grew up. And, excuse me. So it came to a point where I was begging to understand why I was living that life, you know. And I was begging to be relieved of my, as we say now, to be relieved of these defects of character. In 95, already I was begging, you know. That's sixth step, eh? But my life turned into a total hell. When I did that in 1995, you know, I asked God for help, expecting to, you know, be immediately taken out of this. It's not quite the way it worked, you know. I had to become ready to be relieved of my defects of character. Entirely ready. It took 10 years. From 95 to 2005, my life was hell, absolute hell. I did things and I went through things that scared me. You know, I actually found myself one morning at 4 o'clock in the morning sitting behind a funeral parlor in back of a big blue Smithright garbage can smoking crack. You know? That's hell. You know? I've done a lot of things in my life. I worked for UPTAD at one point. I was the regional director for the Office of Prevention of Drug Abuse and Alcohol. You know? I ran a halfway house for Ryerson College in Toronto for a while. I worked for Katimovic as the West Coast director. But I was always stoned and I was always using. And, you know, to become a crack addict in an alcoholic place sitting behind a garbage can, you know, was getting pretty close to the bottom, you know. And I kept praying and praying and praying, going to bed at 4 o'clock in the morning. It wasn't my bed, so I couldn't go in my room anymore. I was scared to go in my room. All these shadows and feelings and stuff, you know, like, you get pretty crazy, eh? You know, near the end there. Whoa. It was bad. Oh my God. I could sit in my house and hear people talking 5 blocks away, you know, like, about me. You know, I used to peek out the corner of my window, see what was going on in the world, you know, so I was scared. I was really, really scared. And I know I was going to die from one day to the other, so it didn't really matter, you know. But I was so sad and sorry, you know. I was intoxicated to a degree where I believed that I deserved to die an alcoholic, you know. And I used to I had set up a cot in the corner of my living room because I couldn't go into the back room anymore, my apartment. And I'd crawl onto my cot there at 3-4 o'clock in the morning, and every night pretty well. And I'd say, please, Lord, you know, take it away. And I'd say, that was my prayer. It was very simple. I'd just say, thank you for not killing me today. You know, because I kept hoping, maybe tomorrow, you know. Maybe tomorrow he'll take it away. And on July 4th, 2005, intervention finally came. The night before, I have a 20-year-old daughter that I somehow managed to raise. She's going to Dawson now in education. I'm very proud of her because she somehow managed to survive this. And she still loves me very much. I don't know why. She sees something in me. I'm starting to see it and feel it, you know, but she loves me. But she was working for Sun Youth that summer, the summer camp. She was coming back, and I'd been binging for a week solid, you know, and blowing everything. The rent money was gone. Everything was gone as usual. And, And I was sitting there reminiscing about how much of a worthless piece of garbage I was, you know, again. And I was fully convinced. I mean, many times in my life I looked at, you know, this suicide thing. I said, how come people do that? You know, why do people do that? And I always, you know, looking at it, I always thought, inconceivable. I could never do something like that, you know. But that night, I thought I could. I thought it was the only thing I could do, you know. I was on the third. And strangely enough, I picked up, you know, because I was thinking about it, I realized how close I was to doing this, you know, because I hated myself so much. And I thought, you know, just not worth it, just not worth it. You know, maybe if I finish this, I can start over in another life and, you know, won't make such a mess of it, you know, with God's help. And I looked up and I remember looking at the door, the front door, and it was almost like a ghost I saw of my daughter coming home and finding me, you know. And my heart was broken, you know, still today I hurt at that time. And I couldn't do that to her, you know. I just couldn't do that to that little person, that beautiful creature that she is, you know. It would have destroyed her, I know it, you know. And so I decided I really need help. I really need help, you know. I grabbed the phone book and I'm thinking, wow, I got to do something about this. I got to do something for myself, you know. So I'm looking for a rehab center to call to get some help, you know. And I opened the West Island phone book and there's one phone number for a rehab center and it's Freedom House in Levalterie, outside of Montreal here. And by the time I found that number, the rush had passed, and there was another piece of crack and another glass of scotch, so I kept drinking and smoking, and I forgot about the rehab center. But the phone book stayed open on that page. And the next day, I got busted by the police on possession of coke and drunk and disorderly. We had a bunch of friends in the car, and we got pulled over, and I ended up sitting in jail because I already had a conviction for possession from the year before. So I'd broken my conditions. And I ended up, that was on the 4th, on the 4th of July. On the 6th, I ended up in front of the judge, Judge Mass, the provincial judge. And she's the lady who had given me a break the year before. And she looked at me and she said, are you absolutely out of your mind? You know? And I was going to, you know, I was going to give her a line, right? You know, oh, well, you know, with whatever. And I was about to open my mouth. And again, I was saved. Because I heard something in my head. I thought how badly I needed help. And I thought, why don't you try telling the truth, you know? Why don't you try telling this lady the truth? Maybe it can help you, you know? And I realized, I took my first step that day. As I told her, I said, you know, my drug addiction, my alcoholism is at a point where I can't control anything anymore. My life is absolutely, totally, totally wasted, you know. And she looked at me and she said, are you asking for help? I said, yeah, I need help badly, you know. So 2 days later, I found myself in rehab. Guess what rehab? Freedom House. Coincidence, right? You know? Strangely enough, I was sitting in Freedom House. So after a month of being there, I started to get straight. I was really very heavily intoxicated, very heavily intoxicated, and it took me quite a while to come down. And after about a month, I'm looking around at all these crazy people, and really, what the heck am I doing here, you know? And how am I going to get out of here? You know, this is people are nuts, right? I'm okay, you know. Not that I'm straight, I'm okay. In a month, right? And I just said, what am I doing here? I think, what am I doing with these people here in this place? You know, and then I heard you ask for help, remember? You know, and I thought, oh yeah, I asked for help, right. You know, maybe I should try to see what's going on here, you know. So in my second month, I started looking out and trying to understand what they were trying to do for me, you know. And a major breakthrough was because there was this fellow, Bill, Jimmy, actually. And I heard him do a share. We had every Thursday AA meetings. It was part of the program, you know. So, but one night he shared, and he was the resident at the house. He was just about to leave. He had finished the 6-month program. When I heard his share, you know, and I saw this person was a very beautiful man, big heart, very beautiful person, you know, beautiful person. And I went up to him afterwards, and I said, "How did you manage to get out of that mess? You know, how did you manage to do it?" And he had a copy of 12-12 in his hand. And he looked at me and he says, "It's in here." He said, "Study this book." He said, "Don't just read it." He said, "Study this book, right? You know." So I looked at him and I went, "Well, okay, you know, I'll try it." Took it back with me to my room, started reading. And I got really hooked when I read the line that there has never been, never have we... have we made honesty, tolerance, love of God, and love of man the motivation of our everyday lives? When I read that, I thought, you know, that for some reason I felt that that's what's been missing for me, you know? That little bit of spice, you know, that little bit, that little taste that was there, that emptiness that I felt all my life was what it was, you know? Living for a purpose, you know? And I started to change. I really didn't believe that I could change. You know, I'm talking about a 40-year addiction, eh? It was pretty well washed out by then, you know. Chances were pretty small. But at the end of 6 months, I was a model resident. You know, I was escorting people to court. You know, and I was responsible for all the groups in the house and the whole thing, and I'm straight and I'm clean and, you know, I didn't go out of there for 4 months. I closed therapy for 4 months before I took a weekend out. And my first weekend out, I was sitting at the park in front of Shadows. And I had to do a weekend, a meeting, you know, as part of my conditions. So it's my first weekend out of 4 months. I got a couple $100 in my pocket, and I'm looking at Shadows across the street. I'm sitting at the park, the bench there, across the street. I'm looking at the door of Shadows. And I'm thinking, am I going to go in there or am I going to call the dealer? You know, like 4 months. And I'm So all of a sudden the door opens and this woman steps out. Who I know now is Nancy. I'm sure some of you know Nancy, eh? You know Nancy, she's a beautiful lady, eh? And she looks across the street and sees me and comes straight across the street right at me and sits down beside me and says, "Are you having a good day?" You know? And I looked at her. And I thought, well, it's a nice lady sits down beside me and says, "Am I having a good day?" Of course, I'm not going to say I'm having a bad time. Oh, I'm just about again to lie. You know, and I looked at her and I thought about this rigorous honesty. And I thought about it, and I thought, wow, you know. Because I didn't believe, that, you know, I didn't believe that these principles could be carried to all my affairs. You know, in therapy, I was, you know, looking at these concepts, you know, these recommendations. And as I was about to lie and say, "Oh, life is fantastic," you know, like everything's cool, you know, like I looked at her and I thought, here's a beautiful person who comes up to me out of the goodness and kindness of her heart, you know, because she honestly feels it. I need help, and I'm going to lie. And I thought, no, I'm not having a good time. I told her, I said, "No, I'm not." I said, you know, and we talked, and she walked me over to Shadow. That was the first time I went into Shadow. Now I'm in Shadows 5-6 nights a week. Been going on for 2 years, you know. I've actually got almost a regular chair. You know? And it's a good place, you know. Got some good friends there. And you can see I found my smile again, you know. But 6.5 months, I came out of Freedom House, and I signed myself in for another 3.5 month program, reinsertion, because I didn't trust myself yet. But I was getting sober enough not to trust myself. which is a miracle, a total miracle for me. I really, telling you, I'm talking about it, you know, like I say, 40 years of this, you know. And I went to live at the Anchorage Delta program. So 10 months of 2005, I spent taking care of myself, you know. Like, it was probably the first time I did that in my life, actually addressing my problems, getting close to myself, you know. And I was given a break. You know, God was very merciful with me. You know, I was very close to the edge. Now I have, as I say, a regular routine of meetings. You know, I participate in at least a dozen meetings a week. And I've just been